Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is musician and photographer Bernie Gusick. A longtime music colleague of mine, Bernie has regaled his fellow musicians and friends with photographs and stories of his travels for years. Travels that have taken him to six continents. And now he's sharing some of his photos with a larger world. The Sand Springs Cultural and Historical Museum is featuring some of his photography from Eastern India in an exhibit titled Unseen India, featuring photographs from ethnic tribal villages in the state of Orissa and Chhattisgarh, a handful of the 2,000 ethnic groups within India. Bernie Gusick was born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and studied tuba and photography. After high school, he attended and graduated the Juilliard School of Music and has played with the New York Philharmonic, the American Symphony Orchestra, the Cleveland Orchestra and Orchestra Pops, the Kansas City Philharmonic, eventually moved to Tulsa to join the Tulsa Philharmonic, later was a member of the Tulsa Symphony and the Signature Symphony. In the last couple of years, he's retired from professional music and spending time exclusively photographing the world. You can see some of his efforts at the Sand Springs Cultural and Historical Museum, and he'll be speaking this Saturday at 4 o'clock, talking about the exhibit there. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Bernie Gusick, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
I read in your bio for this show at the Sand Springs Museum that you've studied two things in your life intently: tuba, which I've known for a long time as a fellow musician, and photography. Which came first?
They came at the same time, actually. I was 12 years old, and I started with the tuba. And my parents got a 35-millimeter camera, and they thought it was too difficult to operate, so they said, here, you start taking the pictures. So that's the way I started. I basically photographed all our trips, all our fishing trips, until I was 18. Then went off to school. I still had the camera and got the first couple of years at Juilliard on film.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So from your early days at Juilliard, you had like pictures of your classmates or music shots?
No, I kind of stayed away from music with it. It was my other outlet, the other me. And, you know, there's pictures of New York, pictures of where I was living. I lived with a very wealthy philanthropist in a penthouse in the Bronx. So there's a lot of pictures up there of the city and, you know, taking the Staten Island Ferry at night.
Now, a lot of musicians will take their cameras, and actors the same way. They'll almost sort of document what they're doing. But it sounds like you always had a strict divide, because I've never seen you at a concert or even rehearsals taking pictures.
No, I always figured that when I had my horn in my hand, that's what I was going to do. That's where my head was at. I've never been one to have two things going on at the same time. It's easier to concentrate when you only have one thing to do.
Now, before we talk about the photography, let's talk a little bit about your music career. I mean, you really had an amazing career where you went to Juilliard. You probably playing with the New York Philharmonic from time to time, even while you were at Juilliard. The American Symphony Orchestra with Leopold Stokowski. This was his last big orchestra that he led. Well, do you have any memories of Stokowski?
Oh. Stokowski? Oh, God, yes. Stokey, as everybody called him, was really a wonderful man. I mean, of course, he had a temper like most conductors, but most of the time, he was a real gentleman. The way I met him the first time, I was playing Queen's Symphony, and I didn't realize that the conductor, David Katz, was also the personnel manager of the American Symphony. So their regular tuba player left the country to go on a tour, and David called me up and said, do you want to come in for a week? I said, sure. And the first week I came in, Carl Boehm was conducting.
Oh.
Well, Carl Boehm was a conductor you didn't want to mess with.
Old school German.
Very old school German. And I think I only had Symphonic Metamorphosis to play on that program. And I sat there doing rehearsals, and he never said a word to me. I mean, he jumped on everybody else. And I started feeling like, well, maybe I'm not worth anything. He's not saying anything to me, you know? I mean, I was like 20 years old. And the whole week went by like that. Performance, you know, was coming up. Went in, played the Hindemith, went up to the green room, put my horn in the case, got out of there early, which everybody hates to see a tuba player go home early. And as I'm going downstairs, you pass the stage entrance, and Carl Byrne was standing there. And he turns to me with a very stern look on his face, and he shakes his head sideways, and he says, "You know, maybe next time I come back as a tuba player, you get to go home early, I get to stay here. It's not fair." But that was my first time with the American Symphony. I can remember Stokowski completely blowing up. We were doing a radio broadcast, and this was on radio. And he threatened the cellos, you know, to do it his way. And we couldn't believe he was just blowing up on the radio.
Oh, he's yelling on the radio.
Yeah, he was just yelling right on a live radio, you know. And that's the way it was.
Yeah.
You know. So finally, David said, "You need to go over to Stokowski's apartment and play for him." I said, "Fine." So I go over there and take my horn, you know, just a dumb 20-year-old kid, and took a few excerpts with me. His secretary let me in, and there was music all over the place. And he came in, we played a few things. He says, "You'll do fine. You be my tuba player now." And I didn't realize it, but, you know.
That was your audition.
Yeah, that was my audition, and I was with the orchestra for the next 2 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got to play for some really good conductors.
Of course, you were there in New York for a while, then you went to Cleveland and played with orchestras in Cleveland, and then later Kansas City, and then finally here in Tulsa as the tubist for the Philharmonic, and then later the Symphony, and lastly Signature in a long career. But when did photography become more of a real passion as opposed to a release from music?
I think it was when I got into horses and I was riding a lot, started going into horse shows and started shooting pictures at, you know, doing, we had a Grand Prix, big Grand Prix in Cleveland. And that's when I really thought I really liked doing this. And I started doing it more and more on trips. We've traveled all over the world, never to the same spot twice. And I've always been interested in taking pictures of people. But this is the first time that I've ever really gone out and said, "Okay, folks, here's my work. You can like it, you cannot like it, but this is real interesting stuff."
Now, you've sold pictures,
yes,
for various things. When did that become, you say, you know, I'm going to actually do this as a way of sharing it with others other than being your own personal photographs of your travels and things like that?
Well, it was interesting. A good friend of mine who's also my dentist here has pictures up on the ceiling. And he said,
for when you're looking up?
Mm-hmm. So when you're laying on your back, you got something to look at. And, you know, for years and years, you look at the same thing. I said, "Greg, you know, how about some new pictures up there?" Well, it so happened that I needed a new bridge coming in. And we worked out a deal, and I did 22 metal pictures for him to put up on the ceiling. And, you know, it helped me out. It helped him out. And people come in and they see them. And I keep some cards there, and they call every now and then. And if I get a portrait setting or something like that, I'm happy. It's just a little bit extra money, but it's a lot of fun. I've done some model jobs, and I've walked out on model jobs because I don't like the attitude of some people, and I don't need it.
Yeah, that's true. Photography, in your last years of knowing you as a musician, it was like every time I would see you, it says, "Here's some of my latest photos." You know, you're very excited about what was going on. And there really were some amazing photographs of places you've traveled. When did that start?
I really don't know. I think it's been itching at me all along to really try to share pictures of where we've been with people. A lot of people don't travel. It's amazing. You get such an education when you travel. You can watch television, you can read the paper, but everybody seems to have their own agenda. But when you actually get on the ground and you're talking with these people, you find out that things aren't what you think they are. I mean, there are sometimes you have to be very careful. Like on the India trip, twice politics came up. And that makes me uncomfortable to have to talk about politics in another country.
American politics?
American politics.
Right.
So you walk a very thin line. We had one gentleman, he had a cigarette company. They actually, you know, got the raw materials. And he told me, this is an interesting story. He told me, we tried to sell these cigarettes in the United States, but they accused us of using child labor. I said, did they come over and see this? No. And he said, look around here, and I can take you to the fields. We don't use child labor. Mm-hmm. So basically, he was being held back for somebody else's reason, you know, to stay out of the country.
Right. What's apparent in this show, Unseen Idiots, you really focus on faces and the people that you see. I mean, that seems to be a big focus of these photographs. And these are various ethnic groups within, I guess it's an area of India that most travelers don't go to.
No.
Tell us a little bit about this show.
Okay. This area is specific, the mountain area. It's close to the Sea of Bengal. It's maybe,
is it north of Bangladesh?
It's south.
South of Bangladesh.
South Bangladesh.
But it's actually to the east of Bangladesh?
East and down.
Okay. So very close to Myanmar.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The permits that we got allowed us to go into the villages where tourists aren't really welcome.
Mm-hmm.
India's still very tribal. But when we went in with tribal permits and a guide who spoke 17 different dialects and a driver, just Carla, myself, and the two.
It's your wife, Carla.
Yeah, Carla. And it was, I'm not going to say it was a culture shock. It was just like being in another world. It was more like almost being on movie sets because you just don't, I never thought of India as Africa. The Indians started off in the Middle East and they left about the time of Abraham 5,000 years ago. They went down to Africa and stayed for a couple thousand years, then went around and came up and settled in India. The area that we went into still carries that African culture with them, and they live by everything that they were taught by back then. I mean, they raise their own crops. They have their own cattle. They don't need anything else. The only thing that bothers them is when somebody comes in and tries to take something from them. And the Dangari tribe has a modern-day story that's very similar to the whole storyline in Avatar.
Really?
They have
The movie Avatar.
They have a mountain that contains bauxite. They worship this mountain. They live off of this mountain. And this company came in, built a factory, thought they could walk in and take this mountain away from them.
And basically displace the indigenous population.
Right. Mm-hmm. The government of India actually backed the Dangari tribe, which was kind of strange because it's, you know, money and politics. It ended up in court, and the first two battles have been won by the Dangari. They've had international lawyers come in to take care of them. All the costs were, you know, donations and everything. But it's just like, this is a modern-day Avatar, you know? These people are magnificent. I mean, they're subsects of them, and you can tell the difference of who they are basically by the jewelry they wear or the clothing they wear. And, you know, it's...
Well, in this photographic exhibit, I think I counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 or 8 different ethnic groups out of the 2,000, which are a part of India. And I assume this was all in a very small area, or was this over a larger area of your travels?
No, it was basically in two states of India, Orissa and Chandigarh.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was the focus of your photo taking? Was it just documenting what you saw, or was there a particular story that you wanted to capture on this trip?
No, I really wanted to go after portraits. That really intrigued me. And, you know, I did some searches on Flickr on some of these different tribes. And this is really interesting. I want to get some pictures that aren't online, you know. I wanted to get pictures that the everyday person wouldn't have a chance to see.
Now, when I saw the show, one of the things that struck me was, I said, am I seeing like you would see in, say, Eastern Europe or some places in Africa or even in the Americas, where I'm seeing people dressed in indigenous garb as a part of a group of outsiders coming in to be, you know, to show them the culture, if you will, you know, the tourist shots. And then I went online and I found, oh no, this is the way these people dress. This is this, and it's the most colorful clothing, the most vibrant dyes used to create their dress. It's just overwhelming, the technicolor experience of seeing these folks.
Well, I had the same question that you have. Why do they dress like this? Is this a show?
Right.
So I asked Babek, our guide, why? He said, usually on Wednesdays or Saturdays when they have the market, the women come to market and they kind of dress up for each other. And they have tea parties and they have little meetings. And
so it's like going, if I can, excuse me, if I can make the analogy, it's like going to church on Sunday.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's real special. And you don't see the men in these things. Every now and then you'll see a man and he'll have a scarf around his neck. And that'll actually say what village he's from. But mostly you don't see the men. We were in Bastia in a tribe outside of there, and they did the bison dance for us. We were the only two people there. And to see these people, to see the men wearing these bison horns and shells over their face, and the women with spears with bells on them. And actually, I'll tell you, if you want, I can do something special for you.
So what are we hearing here?
That's the bison dance.
Ah.
And again, the musician in me kind of took over at that point and said, you know, with the iPhone and the pictures, I just want the sound. So I grabbed the sound and put it on my iPad. It was mostly just drums and bells. But in the Gadaba tribe, we got a chance to hear early instruments like the sham. And when we were there, again, we were by ourselves, and I was taking pictures. My wife was sitting next to me. Sometimes she's intimidated a little bit when we go into these villages because she doesn't like to feel like she's looking at people. And I can understand that completely. But
of course, that's a photographer's job, is to look at people.
Yeah, the women were dancing, and they passed by. One of them grabbed her arm and pulled her right into the dance. And all she could think, all she said to me is, all I could think of is, I'm going to step on somebody's foot. So, you know, they danced around with her for a while, and they got a big kick out of it. And she made a really close friend. And Carla was almost in tears when we left this village. Because here was a stranger reaching out to her in friendship. And it was really heartfelt and warm. And it really touched her.
Now, a number of the photographs are surrounding the Unukudeli market. What was that market like?
Almost all the markets were alike. At one point, Babek brought us a bag of red ants and larvae.
Red ants and larvae.
Red ants and larvae. He said, I'm going to show you how people used to eat. We're going to have this for dinner tonight.
Red ants and larvae.
Red ants and larvae. And the look on my wife's face was, oh, he's really gone over the edge this time. It's not the first time. I mean, I've eaten some things that on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being good and 10 being forget it, I've had some 20s. I mean, you know, if anybody ever shows me dried shark from Iceland again, and I tasted it. You know, just shoot me. But anyways, it was very good. The red ants were very good. They served it on the side, and it was okay, but when you put it on the rice, it was really good. So I could see how people could really survive on this high protein.
Yeah.
It was interesting. They sold a lot of cotton. They sold a lot of saris, a lot of cheap plastic jewelry. Not for tourists. There are very few tourists in these markets.
I was going to ask about one of the images which is going into the show at a later date, and that is of these women with these little jugs.
Oh, the women with the jugs. As I said, it was a most of these tribes are matriarchal, and they don't have much use for men except for maybe procreation or taking care of the cattle. And they make their own type of liquor, which I wanted to try, which our guide said, no, that's not for you. Famous last words, that's not for you. So I noticed these, maybe a half a dozen women sitting there, and they were selling it in these big aluminum jugs. And one was holding a baby, and the one on the end looked like she'd been sampling of stuff because she didn't look too happy. And it was just a picture that, you know, my pictures aren't set up pictures. I never stage a picture. I might wait for something, but I don't ask anybody to stand a particular way. I don't wait till the sun gets a particular, I take what I get. A lot of this stuff is very fast shooting street photography. You don't have time to really set up. And that's the exciting part about it. It's kind of like fishing. You don't know what's going to come, you know, or diving. You don't know what you're going to see, you know, around a corner or behind a rock. That's what I find extremely exciting.
Well, you had one experience like that. In India, you have to go to Agra and you have to go to the Taj Mahal. What did you find there? Because there's some really beautiful images from the Taj Mahal that sounds like it was pure serendipity.
We went to the Taj Mahal an evening before and got some sunset pictures, which, you know, normal tourist things would do. And I looked at the Taj and I figured out where I wanted to be the next morning. So we got to the Taj at 6 o'clock and very strong security. Very strong security. Got there at 6 o'clock. At 6:30, they opened up they separated the men from the women, like they would in the Middle East. And we got back together, and we took off for the spot that I wanted to get to. And I started shooting, and all of a sudden, these women show up, and they're dressed in saris, and they're taking pictures of each other with their iPhones. There was one other photographer there at that time, and I went up to one of the women, and she spoke a little bit of English, and she told me that they were with a Czech ballet company. She didn't tell me which one it was. And I asked her if it'd be all right to shoot some pictures. She said, of course. And so I had three different women actually modeling for me. And here we are in a strange place, and it's more like a photo shoot going on. But the sun is coming up, and the shadows and the golden sun on the Taj just blew my mind. And, you know, I must have run off. Probably 100 pictures in 15 minutes. But that's what you do. You know, you try different things to get different shots. And I was really, really lucky when I got home and started doing the processing. You know, most people think that photography, you take a picture, you know, it's like with an iPhone or something, and that's it. Well, with this type of photography, that's just the beginning.
Oh, no. It's you do hundreds of images.
Of and the maybe, same thing sometimes.
And maybe one will be the one you want.
Yeah. No, I've been known to work on one image through 20 different cycles to start over. And each time it's half hour, 40 minutes, you sit at the computer. Nah, that's not what I want. Nah. And it goes on that way. And you revise and you revise. And you dwell on your memory of exactly what was happening. And you want to give it the right shadows and the right glow to make it really pop. And
so it sounds like you're a fan of technology. You use every technical tool at your means, as opposed to pure image that you captured with film.
Film was one thing. It was a great thing. I never processed film myself. It would have been the same thing had I processed, because you had the option of burning things in or making them lighter with film. And now you have the option of doing almost anything you want. Digital photography is fantastic.
So this show and the reaction to it, is it spurred you to show your work more often?
Yeah, I think we're starting to plan another trip, major trip next year. We're in the real early stages, and we're both a little bit nervous about what we're going to do. We're thinking about going out into the Sinai and photographing Bedouin tribes that haven't been photographed before. And right now, we're working with the government to get security to go in with us. This is not an area that you want to go into. This is not a tourist kind of trip. Like, you know, things have changed. This last trip really flipped us over into going where other people haven't gone. So, and it kind of interests me. We spent 3 weeks in Israel in the West Bank, and I have a lot of religious pictures there. And since Moses made the trek through the Sinai, I want to see how the Bedouins live and see how it compares to the Bible. Because what I really want to do is do another program next year, another exhibition on four major religions. And I think that would be real interesting.
All right. Well, Bernie, it was a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Rich, it was my pleasure, and thank you.
Longtime Tulsa professional musician and photographer Bernie Gusick speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His photographs of the tribal areas of eastern India is currently being featured in a display at the Sand Springs Cultural and Historical Museum through June 3rd, titled Unseen India. You can join him on Saturday at the museum to hear him talk about the photographs he's taken and the people that are the focus of this exhibit. The Sand Springs Cultural and Historical Museum is located at 9 East Broadway in downtown Sand Springs. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks so much for listening.
If you find yourself baffled by Oklahoma's possible version of Medicaid expansion, you aren't alone. But Public Radio Tulsa's The Give and Take is here to help you make sense of this complex issue. Join us Wednesday evening, March 27th at 6 at the Community Food Bank of Eastern Oklahoma for The Give and Take on Medicaid expansion, the Oklahoma Plan, and State Bill 605. This event is free, but registration is required at publicradiotulsa.org.